This one. There's this one. That's good. So what I want to do, I just told Hadassah, is actually to flip the topics and first do the favorite Torah topic, and then come back to finishing up the Rif and the Rimagash, time dependent. And my reason for going that route is because the favorite Torah topic is something that hit me a little while ago, and I've been playing with it, and I really, really like it, and I think it's important. And as opposed to the specific Jewish history of the Rif and the Rimagash, which hopefully we'll get to also, but if we didn't get to the Rif and the Rimagash, that's okay. Like, I can record that and send you a link and whatever it is, but the favorite Torah shiur, it's a different story altogether. So we're going to do that first. With apologies to whoever's late, but I don't apologize much to whoever's late because they're late. So I think I want to go that route. So the only thing I will say is first to thank you for hosting and seeing me. So I'll tell you where the idea came from. We've spent a lot of time over the years just discussing, so what are we going to learn next? Right. And it's been Tanakh, it's been Jewish history, it's been Tefillah, you know, all sorts of different things. I don't even remember all the things that we've done. But you know, I was thinking about as we were getting towards this point. You know, so what's appropriate for a last topic? Like, what do you do? You know, to sort of close things out. And at first, I had this idea for a topic: the most successful Jew. Like, what does that look like? You know, different measures of success. What is it that Hashem wants of us? And who in our history has had the greatest success? And that's like a series. That's not, you know, that's not one shiur. It's a good topic, yeah, but it's one shiur. But then, I mentioned to you a while back that a woman reached out to me. She runs a podcast called Desert Island Torah. And in each episode, someone shares three ideas that they would take with them if they were going to be stuck on a deserted island. And I did it when it does come out. If I remember, I'll send you a link to it. But the concept intrigued me, and so I decided to have a shiur on what that means. Having favorite Torah, like what would you take to the desert island, like. You know, I found out afterwards, I started looking online, like there are people who do this with music and all sorts of other things, like what would you take to Desert Island? So, but how do you figure that out when it comes to Torah? How do you decide what your favorite Torah is? And is it a good thing to have favorite Torah? Is it helpful? Are you allowed to have favorite Torah? There's a particular Gemara in Erevin, which makes it sound like you're not allowed to. So that's where I wanted to go with this, because I think it's an important idea, and I think it hopefully influences the way we think about how we learn and what we learn and how we respond to what we learn. Clear? That's the idea. I brought you on the sheet two sources. The first one is from the Nitziv, and I must have quoted this at some point. It's the Nitziv talking about having a favorite mitzvah that resonates. It shows up more than once in his commentary to the Torah. In number one, it comes from Parshas Balak, where, and actually, you know, for those who are looking for a Parsha Dvar Torah for this is like. So the Nitziv is talking about the bracha that Bilam gives to Bnei Yisrael, and he says, "Kiganos alei nahar." He says, "We are like gardens on a river." So, keeping in mind that the Nitziv lived in, as you see on the sheet, in Volozhin, in what was, I think, at that time, Russia. It was Russia at the time, at the end of the 19th century. He talks about gardens in, you know, the philosophy of having a garden. And he says the following. Take a look at number one. I'll just read out my English translation in the interest of time. He says, "That which grows in a garden is not like that which grows in a field. A field is planted with only one or two varieties, as opposed to gardens which have many kinds of seeds. Still," he says, "each garden has one central variety, and it's only that small quantities of other varieties are planted around it." He says, when you have a garden, so you have a central color, a central theme to it, and then everything else sort of complements the central color or theme. So he says, that's what a Jew is like. He says, each Jew is filled with the mitzvos of Hashem, but each has one special mitzvah in which he's extra careful. As seen in the Mechilta, one who performs a single mitzvah faithfully is worthy of divine inspiration, worthy of Ruach HaKodesh. Regarding the Mishnah that says, one who performs a single mitzvah receives goodness, the Yerushalmi explains this refers to performing a mitzvah with exceptional care. The Rambam has an idea like this as well, about the value of a mitzvah that you perform in a particularly good way. So sometimes people have a favorite. In this case, he's talking about a favorite mitzvah. Sometimes people have the opposite of a favorite. If you take a look at number two, this is my translation of a piece from Amos Oz. I was going to put his original on, the original Hebrew, but I couldn't find the Hebrew that I translated it from, but it's from his book, Po Vashem Be'eretz Yisrael, in which, people familiar with Amos Oz? Start from that point? Israeli writer? Okay. So, now you will be if you weren't, but Israeli writer passed away a few years ago, and he's, we've got what we've got, sorry. He says, in his approach to Torah, he says, I see myself as a legitimate heir, an heir to Torah, not a stepchild or a ben sorer or more, or an illegitimate child, but an heir. And the meaning of my status as an heir will certainly shock you. It means that I am free to decide what of this giant estate will stand in my salon and what I will conceal in the cellar. Right? You know, if people receive something in an inheritance, sometimes they really like it and they put it on display and it's, you know, over the fireplace or whatever, and sometimes maybe they have trouble, you know, with it and they don't want to get rid of it because it's a family heirloom, so they'll put it, as he says, in the cellar. So that's his approach to Torah. Some things in Torah he loves and he wants to put out on display, and some things give him a hard time. So he wants to not think about it. He's going to sort of bury that in the basement. And he says, certainly future generations will have every right to reverse the order, decorating their lives as seems good in their eyes. He says, I'm not getting rid of it. Anything that's in Torah, I'm not going to eliminate it if I have trouble with it. But on the other hand, you know, I don't want to think about it. And this is somebody who, on the one hand, learned Torah on a regular basis, got together with a Tanakh group, like he was, you know, that class of Israeli intellectual who took Tanakh very, very, very seriously. But on the other end, you can see, like, we can imagine which things might have been difficult things for him, which things he might have wanted to sort of, you know, hide in the salon. I'm thinking, like, you know, war against the babies of Amalek as being something that might give him a hard time. I think perhaps slavery might give him a hard time, even though, you know, there are ways of understanding, dealing with, you know, these issues, but he might say, you know what? I'd rather not. I'd rather think about things like tzedakah, building a country, and ideas like that. And I'm just guessing. I don't actually know which he put into which camp. Does that resonate? People, you know, understand what he's saying, whether it's something you do or not. But it's something that. So, the goal is to think about, ultimately, why we have favorites, and should we have favorites, and what is our favorite? How do we deal with the things that are decidedly not our favorites? And I want to build off of four ideas, which I connect to one of the times in the Torah where we actually speak explicitly about learning Torah. And it's a pasuk in the beginning of Sefer Yehoshua. The ideas I'm attaching to the pasuk in Yehoshua, it's more of a homiletic. I'm not claiming that it actually literally comes from there, but it's a convenient pasuk for expressing it. In source number 3, when Yehoshua takes over for Moshe, and Hashem says to Yehoshua, Chazak ve'ematz, multiple times, be strong, be courageous, you know, and hold on to the Torah. And he says to him, Lo yomush sefer ha-Torah zemipicha, this book of the Torah shall never move from your mouth. V'hagisa bo yomam v'layla, you shall speak in it day and night, so that you will guard to practice according to all that is written in it. For then you will be successful in all of your ways, va'az taskil, and then you will succeed, or taskil can mean then you will have insight. You see taskil used both ways. So that's what he says to Yehoshua. And I see four ideas within this. First of all, when it says Lo Yamush Sefer HaTorah Hazeh Mipicha, that this Torah shall never leave your mouth, it's the emphasis on picha, that it's your mouth. Your expression has to be within it, meaning when you choose something to learn, picking something that you have a personal connection with. It's more than just something that is out there as an idea, but something for which there's a real personal connection, and that's on multiple levels. First of all, something where the human voice in it is valued can be something that resonates with people. And as an illustration of it, I brought you a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah in source number 4. The context for it is a little bit obscure, but you'll see what I mean when we learn it. The beginning of Maseches Rosh Hashanah tells us that there are 4 Rosh Hashanahs. Right? We know there are different dates that are New Year's dates for different events during the year. And there we are told there's a particular date that's Rosh Hashanah for Yirakos, vegetables, Masros, tithes, and Nedarim for vows. Right? This date is Rosh Hashanah for these purposes. So the Gemara asks, what do you mean when you say a Rosh Hashanah for vegetables? Like, vegetables have a birthday. What is that about? To which the answer is,
how much will grow that year?
No.
Tithing.
Right. Trumos and Maisros. The idea is that every year, shana, you're supposed to separate Trum and Maiser from your produce, and you're not allowed to separate from one year's produce on a different year's produce. It's not effective. It doesn't work. So you need a start of your fiscal year. Right? To say, okay, everything that grew, and defining growth took roots, grew to a certain percentage or whatever it is, but you know, anything that grew before this is the old year. Everything that grew after this is the new year. That's the rule. So when it comes to vegetables, this is the new year for vegetables. Except the Gemara says, I don't understand. You already said masros. Masros means tithes. What's the difference between Yirakos, which is tithing vegetables, and Masros, which is tithing in general? If it's Rosh Hashanah for one, it's Rosh Hashanah for the other. Why are you listing them separately? To which the Gemara explains, no. One is talking about vegetables for which Truma and Maser is Dirabanan, and the other is talking about separating Truma and Maser off on a De'oraisa level. We know that the biblical mitzvah of Truma and Maser is specifically wine. Well, not wine, grapes, but wine. Olives, olive oil, and grain. There's some discussion about tree fruit. But vegetables, that's a derabanan. So we list separately trumas and maestros derabanan and trumas and maestros deoraisa. Clear? What does that have to do with anything? So the Gemara asks, look at the list. The list said yirakos first, then it said maser. Yirakos are the derabanan. Maser is the deoraisa. Why did you put the derabanan before the deoraisa on the list? You should have said the biblical one first, and then the derabanan. The biblical one is certainly the one that we take as a more severe obligation. So the Gemara says, and the reason I brought it is, Aidi de chaviv alei akdama, because the Tana who was teaching this taught the derabanan first, because that's our voice, and that made it chaviv, that made it beloved to him. That which we are able to contribute to Torah is what we appreciate more, we feel closer to. That's, you know, I connect that with mipicha, the idea that it's from a human voice. And it's something where that which we express personally in Torah is necessarily going to be something we enjoy more. If you ever have the experience of a chiddush, of saying something, and it's new, and it's a thought on something in the Torah, it's an insight into something in the Torah, that's something that is truly special, and it becomes a favorite. You know, those who were there last night heard a little bit of this, but take a look in source number 5. It's a passage from the Zohar on Shir HaShirim. It's an idea you probably heard, which says that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. 600,000 letters in the Torah. Now, I don't know how many of you have counted, but there are not 600,000 letters in the Torah. It's like half of that, 300 and something thousand. In a standard Chumash, you can count it. Now that it's available, you know, on databases, it's much, much easier to count than it used to be. But it's nowhere near 600,000 letters. So what do you mean when you say that there are 600,000 letters? So the Shalah, Rabbi Shaya Levi Horovitz in the 17th century, said each letter in the Torah is attached to one of the original 600,000 neshamos. There's this idea that there are 600,000 souls of Jews. You'll ask me, but there are way more than 600,000 Jews. There were even more than 600,000 Jews in the Midbar. 600,000 or 603,550 was just right, the males of military age. So we get this idea, which the Zohar loves, of fragments of neshamos, that there's a soul that is shared and that gets into reincarnation and all sorts of other fun stuff that I do not understand at all. But the idea is that this core idea, there are 600,000 of us, and each of us has a letter in the Torah that's ours, that we connect to. The Vilna Gaon actually expands on this idea. I brought it as Kol Eliyahu in source number 6. He's building on an idea from the Alshech. We say in davening, V'sein chelkenu b'sarasecha, give us our portion in your Torah. He says, there is something that is uniquely yours. He points out, the Gemara says, Mishnah, it's Gemara Megillah, says, if a person says, I worked at it in Torah, and I found, Yagata Umatzata, Tamin, you should believe them. Believe them. If they say they worked at it and they found it, you should believe them. But he says, the language is, I found. When you find something, that's not necessarily an expression of finding something new. He says finding something is when you find what you already had and you lost. Right? Hashavas Aveda, you lose property and then you find it. So that's what you're experiencing with Torah, because you know the Gemara in Nida that says that when you're in the womb, you learn all of Torah. Right? And then you come out, and the Malach slaps you, and you forget it. And that's not where the philtrum comes from under a person's nose. That's not what the Gemara says. Nonetheless, the idea of forgetting, the idea of learning it in the first place is it establishes this is something of yours, which you then forget, and then you need to reclaim. But it will be familiar to you once you're able to reclaim it. So the Vilna Gaon says, that's your portion. When you say in davening, v'sein chalkenu v'sarasecha, right? Comes up in davening on Shabbos, comes up at the end of Shemona Esrei. That's what you're asking for. Give me back my portion, that which is unique to me. Where my voice is expressed. I gave you a link in number 5. That's actually to Toronto Torah that my Beit Midrash publishes from Shavuos, where Rabbi Stephen Gottlieb published a column where he explored this idea that there's something in the Torah that is uniquely of each of us. And the point that he makes there, he's quoting somebody, I don't remember who he's quoting, is to say, and therefore, if any Jew doesn't find their share and teach their share, that means we've actually lost something from Torah. Like, it's vital that all of us have that opportunity. But my first element of a favorite Torah is something that you have a personal connection with, something that is mipicha, it's from your mouth. Clear? Mm-hmm. Good? That's the first step? Okay. Second, something that motivates us to learn no matter the time and no matter the other circumstances. Right? We always have things that are competing for our time and attention. Right, I mentioned last night David Zirkin's classic line. For those of you who knew David when he was with our Beit Midrash, he's now the rabbi at the Jewish Center in New York. But he had this line. We were talking about scheduling a program, and he said, "If you're going to wait for there to be nothing else going on, right? You're going to wait when there's nothing going on." Oh, he didn't say good luck. He said, "If you're going to wait until there's nothing else going on, you're sending a message." Right? Our program is what you do when you have nothing else to do. Right? If you're confident that it's worthwhile, then you just put it out there, and whatever happens, happens. So this is the idea that pick something that's going to motivate you to learn, no matter what else is going on. Which means you want a topic, obviously, that's going to interest you. Right? I brought you the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, number 7. Ein adam lo mitara ele mimakom shalibo chafet. The person only learns Torah from a place that they desire. And place, as Rashi explains on that Gemara, doesn't mean a physical space. It means the subject. The source has to interest you as well. Source number 8, I brought you the story with Rav Chisda. He's talking about Zor L'Chayayim V'Keva. You know that the halacha is that when you shecht an animal, you give certain portions to the Kohen. Right? Today, a Kohen is not able to claim that, even though the mitzvah is still obligatory, but the Kohen is not able to claim it because he has to prove that he's a Kohen in order to have a right to it. So he comes to you and says, give me the Zor L'Chayayim V'Keva. You say, prove that you're a Kohen, and then we'll talk. So therefore they don't end up claiming it. However, the Gemara tells a story about Rav Chisda, who was holding the gifts from the ox that was supposed to be given to a Kohen. And he declared, if anybody can come teach me some new idea from Rav, I'll give him these gifts, because a non-Kohen is able to eat them. It isn't required. It's not like Truma, where it has to be eaten by a Kohen. So he said, I'll give it to whoever can give me a lesson from Rav. Rav was beloved to Rav Chisda, so it has to come from a source that interests you, and it has to be in a format that interests. If you take a look at number 9, this is also a classic. The Gemara in Shabbos about Rabba, that when Rabba used to start a shiur, Amar Milsa Dibidichusa Ubadchi Rabbanan. He would say something humorous, something funny, the rabbis would laugh, and then, Lesof Yasib Be'emso Upasach Bishmaisa. Then he sat in reverence and began the lesson. So some speakers, they start with the Milsa B'Gibichusa, with a joke, and then they just keep on going, and it's a joke all the way through. But some of us aren't as talented as that. And so alright, at least get a joke in the beginning. Get something funny in the beginning, and then after that, it'll be more reverent. But the idea of it being in a format that works is also very important. So I take all of this under the heading of the Hagisa Bo Yom HaValayla, something that you're going to actually want to speak in day and night. It has to be something that's going to attract. Clear? Good? Okay. Third, and this gets towards some of the things that I think are, the first two things I think are relatively obvious. Something you have a personal connection with, something that, is expressed in a way you enjoy, in a topic you enjoy, fine. But something that gives us broad exposure is very important. The pasuk says, with Yahushua, Laman tishmor la'asos kechol ha'kasuv bo, so that you guard according to all that is written in it. A Jew needs to know all of it. You can't just say, I'm going to know this narrow window. Now, I realize it's a women's shiur, and the obligation for women is not the same as the obligation for men in terms of what one needs to know. The males have a different sort of an obligation of just learning everything purely lishma, even if it has no practical relevance whatsoever. Women's core obligation is much more oriented towards what you need to know to be a Jew, right? Which means, you need to know Tanakh, and you need to know halacha. Good luck on all of that. There's an awful lot that's in there. You need to know machshava. So maybe once you finish with that bookshelf, then, there's more to talk about. But the point is that a Jew needs to cross-train. The Gemara in source number, where was it? Number 10, the Gemara in Kiddushin, talks about a person dividing up their years. La'olam yishalish adam shnosav. A person has to divide up their years. Shlish b'mikra, shlish b'mishnah, shlish b'talmud. One third in Tanakh, one third in Mishnah, one third in Talmud, which when the Gemara uses the word Talmud, it means halachic debate. And then the Gemara asks, but people don't know how long they're going to live. So what does that mean, one third in this? So it says, yeah, it means you divide up your day. You divide up your day, and then it says, well, Talmud Bavli includes everything mixed together. But the point is that there's a concern of make sure you're getting everything in. Rav Chaim Vital in number 11 in his Shara Mitzvos actually says, not only that, you have to learn Kabbalah. He says Kabbalah is part of it also. Pshat, Remez, Drush, Sod, you need to know all of that in order to count as knowing Torah. There's a danger when you learn that you might stick with what's fun, right? We stick with what we enjoy. I'll show you something which is always eye-opening to people. When they learn this for the first time, they're like, are you kidding me? Are you serious? But it's a Mishnah, and followed up on in a Gemara. In source number 12, they're talking about what happens, Rachmana Litzlan, if there's a fire on Shabbos, and you're in an area where there's no Eruv. I'm not talking about where there's a threat to life. There's no threat to life. In this hypothetical story, there's nobody whose life is in danger. And you have the ability to take stuff out of the house without being in danger. I can't quite imagine the fire that looks like this. I suspect it has to do with the way their houses were and their property was. And, somehow that you could end up with a situation in which there's a fire burning in a house. it's not a threat to anybody's life, and you're able to get property out of the house on Shabbos. But that's your story. So the question is, there's no Eruv. Taking stuff out of the house on Shabbos means transporting it from private domain into not a public domain, Rishus HaRabim Del Raisa, a biblical prohibition, but an Issur DeRabbanan, carrying it out into a Carmelist. Am I allowed to do that on Shabbos? And they say here, Kol Kisvei HaKodesh Matzilin Osim Ebnei Adeleka, if you have Kisvei Kodesh, if you have Sfarim of Tanakh, is what they're talking about here, you're allowed to save them from the fire. Remember, this is a Mishnah. At that time, they didn't have a written Mishnah. Right? So they're talking about Tanakh. So you can take it out of the house. Bein shekorin bahen, bein she'ein korin bahen. Whether these are Sfarim you're allowed to read on Shabbos, or Sfarim you're not allowed to read on Shabbos. You're not allowed to read on Shabbos. There are Sfarim that you're not allowed to read on Shabbos. So that's what everybody looks at, like, what are you talking about? And the answer is, what you are not allowed to read on Shabbos is Ksuvim.
No.
Huh?
That's what it sounds like, no?
No.
All the Megillahs? All the Megillahs, Eov, Divrei Hayamim. Yeah, isn't that an issue? Isn't that an issue? So as the Mishnah continues, Umnema in Korin Bahen, why don't we read from them? Mipne Bitul Beis HaMedrash. The concern is because no one's going to come learn in Beis Medrash if they can spend their time reading this. Meaning, it's a lot of fun to read this. It's light. It draws the heart. It's got stories and all that. Now, no one ever said that about Eo. But the idea is, in general, Ksuvim is a light read. And we're worried that if people are going to read that, they're not going to read more serious topics. Therefore, you're not allowed to. Now, I will note, because people are asking the question, one is allowed to say Tehillim. You know, I mean, saying Tehillim on Shabbos as a tefillah is a whole other discussion about, you know, only if somebody's in danger or whatever. That's its own discussion. It also seems fairly clear that they only prohibit a sefer like Eov because it's part of this class of Ksuvim. Eov is not drawing the heart. I love sefer Eov, but no
but
one.
I would think you can't read it because it's sad.
Right.
That would be reasonable.
Right, and that's not the reason that they that's not the reason they give. Right, so whether this applies to women is a very interesting question, because they don't have the same chiyuv of, you know. I mean, the whole idea of Bitul Beis HaMedrash is because you sit and learn, I say, you go to work during the week, and you're busy with all sorts of responsibilities during the week. When are you going to learn? Shabbos. So if Shabbos is the one opportunity to hear a shir, then don't blow it sitting and reading nice stories from Sefer Ezra. We want to make sure you're going to learn something that is challenging and difficult and all of that. So don't get me started. Don't get me started. But the core idea that's being expressed, it actually, someone asked the question about what we read Shir HaShirim, and we, you know, on Davka, you know, Shabbos Chol HaMoed. Friday it's read before Shabbos.
Yeah.
But if I remember correctly, Rav Schechter talked about this during COVID. There was an issue during COVID where there were people at the time in the first Yom Tov who were very concerned about being all together for an extended period of time. So that what they wanted to do was to say, you'll daven the straight davening, and then Shir HaShirim Koheles, you can read that afterwards on your own. It doesn't chiyuv to do with a minyan, so let people do it later. And I think he did not like the idea because he said it had to be done before Kriyas HaTorah, because you couldn't do it between the Kriyas HaTorah in the morning and the Kriyas HaTorah Shabbos Mincha. In between those, that's why we do it before Kriyas HaTorah. You ever wonder, why are we reading Rus? Why are we reading Koheles, Shir HaShirim? Why are we reading them before Kriyas HaTorah? We have a rule. Tadir V'sheinu Tadir, Tadir Kodem. You do that which is more frequent first. They should be after. So if I remember correctly, and I haven't looked at the tshuva since it was relevant in practice, which Baruch Hashem it hasn't been, but if I remember correctly, his argument was that it's done before Kriyas HaTorah. Once you've done Kriyas HaTorah, you can't do it until after Mincha, because of this issue.
We do it afterwards.
because you're interrupting Torah? Is
that
why?
Yeah,
because after
that. You did it after Shul for some people.
Oh, for some people, not the main reading.
They don't do a main reading.
Shul is finished, and then they do it right after.
Wait, they don't, they don't. That's fascinating.
Yeah, we have a lot of time.
Okay. That's, I did not know that. Okay. Look at that. 14 years in the community, and now I learn what Viewman is doing. Okay.
And then, you know, if you want to do something else, is it okay if you want to, like,
right. So that's always an interesting question. What if you're not going to learn something else? Like, this is going to be my learning. If I'm going to learn, it's going to be reading Mishlei. So that's a very interesting question that
I mean, it's a very
that one would need to discuss.
No, but that's nothing to do with this. They're saying not to learn Suvim.
Right.
Women do that a lot. They get together, they say Tehillim, there's
Right. No, I'm familiar. I think part of the answer would be to go back to the women-men distinction in terms of their obligations. I think that's definitely a piece of it. I also think that even though they're not doing it to cry out to Hashem necessarily, nonetheless, you're not looking at it as Talmud Torah either.
No.
It's done as tefillah.
It is.
And no one is saying you can't say Pesukei Dezimra on Shabbos. Uh-huh. I mean, which in any case is pre-Kriyas HaTorah, but you know what I'm saying. It's not, I don't think that's coming under this heading. But if someone said to me, I'm sitting here on Shabbos and I have two choices, right? One choice is to read, you know, whichever tabloid you're going to name, which I'm being recorded, so I'm not going to name. But if my choice is to read the tabloid or for me to read, you know, Sefer Ezra, I would tell them 10 times out of 10, read Sefer Ezra. Of course you read Sefer Ezra. But that's to me a very important third piece of this, is that what we learn should be something that gives us broad exposure. You know, it's still Tanakh. It's still incredibly valuable. It's still a mitzvah of Talmud Torah. But you want broad exposure. And if someone is going to use their only learning time that they have available to learn something, you know, that's this narrow, and they're never going to get the exposure because during the week they're running around everywhere. And now on Shabbos they take the only available time to learn this, then chaval, they've lost something.
So Nevi'im is okay.
Because Nevi'im is not something, no, because the words of the Nevi'im tend not to be considered something that people want to hear. People don't like hearing Musar. Most people don't like hearing Musar. You open up Yeshaya, you open up Yirmiyahu, and you're like, oh no, he's going to yell at me again. So yes, it's less emotional. Even though Navi includes Yehoshua. Navi includes Shoftim, right? Shmuel. I mean, Malachim already is so depressing. Shoftim is depressing. But you know, it's not like they're really a block like that. Okay. I mean, Ksuvim also, you could argue, has lesser Kedusha than Nevi'im. Yeah, there are other points. The last point, in some ways, is the most crucial. And that is to learn things that challenge our preconceptions. And this brings me back to Amos Oz and his dislike for that which is, that which he's uncomfortable with and leaving it in the basement. The Pasuk with Yahushua said, "Az tatzliach es derachecha," then when you do this, you will succeed in all of your ways. And "Va'az taskil," I'm going to take taskil as, then you will have insight. You gain insight when you're forced to confront something that is uncomfortable, something that is challenging, something you look at and say, whoa, is that really in the Torah? Eshe Sifas Torah, that's there. When you have to think about it and confront it, you go much further and you grow much more. So there's a Gemara in Erevin, which I mentioned, I referenced it in the beginning, in source number 13. Kol ha'omer shmua zu na'a v'zu eina na'a. Anyone who says, this lesson is pleasant, this lesson is not pleasant. Ma'abed hona shel Torah. Loses the wealth of Torah. You can't say, I like this, and I don't like that.
Can you say I like this?
Sorry? So that's the question, right?
Can you say I like this?
Right, that's the question. Without a doubt, there is room for, first of all, knowledgeable debate and disagreement. The Rashash points that out on that Gemara. If you take a look at number 14, the Gemara in Kiddushin, where Ula responds to a lesson of Rav Huna, quoting a pasuk in Mishlei, he says, which he presumably didn't learn on Shabbos, but Ula says, "Hadir Rav Huna kechometz l'shinayim ukeashan la'einayim." He says Rav Huna's lesson is like vinegar to the teeth and like smoke to the eyes. This is terrible. But it's an intellectual disagreement. No, he learned the idea, and he said, this is just wrong. And that was his way of voicing his dispute with Rav Huna's idea. But if you don't explore it at all, then as the Me'iri writes, you lose out on the things that you don't understand. It's fine to take the first half, to say, I like X. We saw already the Gemara Avodah Zarah. That's what you're going to want to learn, is that which appeals. But to say, I don't like, is a big problem. You miss out on so much. That doesn't mean that our topic for the last however many years, we should have picked the things that people don't like, because then we wouldn't have had a shiur. You have to balance it out. But that's really important. The Gemara in Megillah points this out, in source number 15. The last of the sources here, where it talks about the tochacha, right? Two times. I'm wondering, like, who in the world walked in behind me that everyone's saying that? Oh, wow. Okay. Now I know. Mazel tov. The Gemara in Megillah talks about how we read the tochacha. Twice in the Torah, Bnei Yisrael are about to enter Eretz Yisrael. We're about to come into Israel. The first time, the end of Sefer Vayikra. Right? We're getting ready to leave Har Sinai. We leave Har Sinai in Parshas Baloscha. That's, you know, Parsha we read last Shabbos. But we're getting ready to leave Har Sinai, and Hashem says, okay, here's your covenant entering Eretz Yisrael. You're going to come into Israel. If you do the mitzvos, it's going to be amazing. Everything is going to grow. Your animals are going to produce. Everything is going to be great. Your enemies will be afraid of you, and so on. You don't? Then these horrible punishments are coming to you. Then we get into Sefer Bamidbar, the spies with their mission, the bad report, 40 more years in the Midbar, the generation dies out, and again, they're ready to enter Eretz Yisrael. And so, in Parshas Kisavo, you get, again, a presentation of this bris, where we're told, if you do the mitzvos, all of these wonderful things will happen to you, and if you don't, awful things are going to happen to you. Some differences between the first version of it and the second version of it. The second version of it is a lot longer. The second version of it is presented as though it's Moshe's words, whereas in the Chukosai, it's Hashem speaking. The one in Kisavo is presented more like it's Moshe. So the Gemara here talks about how we read that Tochacha, and it brings specifically that we don't break it up into separate aliyos, at least for the ones that are in Parshas Bechukosai, which Hashem said directly. Because if you break it up into separate aliyos, it's like it's medicine that you don't want to take. So I'm just going to take it in small doses. So, yeah. But not as a ripping off the band-aid thing, but rather as a thing to say, Hashem, I'm here, I'm listening. I hear what you're saying to me, I hear the rebuke. We don't want to look like we're rejecting it. And the Gemara tells the story of someone who got up for Kriyas HaTorah, Levi Barbuti, and he reads it, and he's megamgim, he's muttering in front of Rav Huna, because he can't bear it. And that's a minhag in many shuls. Maybe Vimat doesn't do that either, I don't know. But a minhag in many shuls is that it's read in a low voice and very quickly, and it's always disturbed me, because, no, you're not supposed to say, I want to get rid of this. You are, but you're not. And my point in bringing it, again, is just to support this point, that the thing you choose to learn has to challenge your preconceptions. It shouldn't be something that is just goes along with what I already knew and liked and you know, all well and good. You know, there should be something that challenges you. And in truth, the four pieces of advice that we're looking at, right, was number one, something that expresses your voice, right? That you can learn and add to, something that motivates us to learn, no matter where we are, no matter what time it is, something that gives us broad exposure within Torah, and also something that challenges our preconceptions. So how in the world can you choose something that satisfies all four? I mean, there are contradictions internally in this. Something that appeals to you is not going to be something that challenges your preconceptions, because people don't like their preconceptions being challenged. So how do you do that, right? And to me, the answer is time. Your favorite can change over time. We need exposure over time to different things, to learn our preferences, to challenge ourselves. The favorite changes over time because we change over time. And so what's your favorite today shouldn't be your favorite tomorrow. There should be something that you like now, and there's something that you learn to like, or that you explore and then eventually, develop an attachment to over time. You follow?
Mm-hmm.
That's the idea. I hope that you understand why I wanted to do that first. So that's something that I'm number one, I really like this idea. It's now my favorite Torah for the moment. But also because I think that it's a practical point that's important when we think about what we're going to learn. I don't know what your husband is thinking about for this year, for next year. But I think that asking that question of, what's going to challenge me, and what am I going to enjoy and is going to bring me out? Like, those are, you know, those are really crucial things for somebody to think about. Yeah.
You know, when people do sit and learn all day, whatever, some of them choose to be in a kollel for halacha, some choose, and they find a strength in that. Like, they like that better, or they...
Absolutely.
So, you're not allowed to?
You are allowed to, I think.
You have to keep other things in mind. But I find people become very focused on what they're doing.
Right, and that worries me. I don't think that's supposed to happen. I mean, if someone says, look, I learned all of Shas, and I'm doing Chazara on it, but I want to spend the rest of my time when I'm not reviewing it on something else, that's great. That's wonderful. You know, maybe he should add Rambam to his Seder, but like, that's overall, that person can say, okay, so I choose to focus on what I enjoy. And if he's got the time for it and willing to support himself, that's great.
You're speaking in five different issues.
Yeah. But you don't want to become somebody who's very narrow, you know, specialized. We live in the age of specialization,
right.
but it's a danger.
It is a danger.
You know, it really
is. It's a little
is.
Bit of an ego, because people like to feel like they're an expert on something. To be an expert on everything is very difficult, so they choose one thing and then it makes them feel good.
Right. No, that's true. And look, people, you know, most people, their time is limited also. You know, that's definitely a big element of it. All of these are important factors. Clear?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So when the link comes out for the Desert Island Torah podcast, I will send that out. Yeah, maybe it's waiting for Pesach time. The Divrei Torah weren't particularly Pesach related. The only thing I will say from it, and I brought it at the end of the sheet, it was in number 16, is one of the three ideas that I really am attached to, is a Sifri on Parshas Ha'azinu. Sifri is halachic medrash for the most part, but this line is not halachic per se. In Parshas Ha'azinu, we say of Hashem, he is Kel Emunah. Kel Emunah. A God of faith, right? You could read that legitimately as a trustworthy God. But then what should the words be in Hebrew? Ne'eman, right? It doesn't say Ne'eman. It says Emunah. So on this, the Medrash says in number 16, Kel Emunah Sheha'emin Ba'olam Ubra'o. Hashem trusted in the world and created it. I sometimes hear people say this about the Pasuk in Moda Ani, right? We say Hashem is Rabba Emunah Secha, that Hashem has faith in us, which is not pshat there at all, because that's a Pasuk from Eicha, which means something very different. But it is the Medrash here on the Sifri. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, actually, in his Tehillah Fractured World, quotes this and talks about the classic Midrashim in which Hashem is going to create human beings, and Hashem summons Malachim and asks them, should I create human beings? And the best one out of those stories, I don't know if I should say the best, I'm going to share about favorite Torah, but the Gemara talks about how Hashem creates a group of Malachim and says, should I create human beings? And the Malachim say no, and Hashem burns them. And then Hashem creates a second group of Malachim and says, should I create human beings? And they say no, and Hashem destroys them as well. And then Hashem creates a third set of Malachim and says, should I create human beings? And they said, look, you know what you want to do.
Right.
How they knew what happened before, I don't know. But that's the. They say, you just do what you want to do. Leave me alone. But the idea is that Hashem is willing to take this leap of faith for human beings. And first of all, I find that to be a beautiful, beautiful idea, because we often don't have the faith in ourselves that Hashem has in us. You know, we don't think we can do it, but Hashem knows you can. So I think that's a very powerful and important idea. But connecting it back here to the last point about favorite Torah, of learning the things that we have difficulty with, if Hashem has that faith in us, maybe, you know, makes sense for us to have that back and to say, there's something here I don't understand. There's something here that doesn't appeal to me. There's something here that I have difficulty with. Amalek, Avadim, Eshes Yipas Torah, all the things that we mentioned before. But to say, I will have that emunah back, you know, reciprocate to Hashem as well, and learn it and try to understand it.
Thank you.
Can I just go back?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Can I go back to that?